Blog Talk Radio.
Good afternoon, everybody. This is obviously not Janine Loudon. This is actually Dan Aronson, host of Coffee Parties Press One for Democracy. Janine is ill today. However, we do have a very cool treat for you. Janine was recently a guest on the Tim Danahy show, and so we're going to be replaying the Janine's interview from that show, and I think you will enjoy it. It covers a bunch of great topics, and we'll obviously have the chat room open so you guys can talk to each other in the chat room. And if you wish to, and you have the ability to, go ahead and you can contact Janine and wish her to get better, as we all do, of course, because we love and miss our Janine when she's not well. So without further ado, here is Janine's interview on the Tim Danahy Show.
Today on the Tim Danahy Show, Arizona, Monsanto, wondering if John Boehner thinks our mission is in Afghanistan, corporate welfare, and more. Janine Loudon of the Coffee Party Radio and I take no prisoners. It's all here at Danahy.com. Welcome back to the Tim Danahy Show here at Danahy.com, and today is our every other week segment for which I still haven't come up with an appropriate title, but it's with Janine Loudon of the Coffee Party USA, and it's the show where we review a number of topics in the news, or even news that big media hasn't covered or covered well. And first of all, Janine, welcome back.
Thanks, Tim. It's wonderful to be here.
Well, it's so much fun to have you on the show, and it was great feedback from our first show, and I'm looking forward to continuing this. It's just a fun conversation with you about a number of different things. But before we get started, let the listeners know about Coffee Party USA and your show.
Well, Coffee Party USA, our motto is incite civility in reason. And so we're not a candidate-based organization, we are an issue-based organization. And for us, there are three key issues in the United States today, campaign finance reform, tax code reform, and Wall Street reform. And so most of the work I do in media, whether it's radio or blogging or posting on Facebook, join the Coffee Party Movement Facebook page, it's about connecting the dots that sort of show how money in politics, for example, can affect issues that don't seem related at all. And so it sort of makes me a sleuth, an investigative sleuth of truth. There you go.
Well, there's certainly a lot to cover. And Janine, I should thank Coffee Party because you've been gracious enough to add me to your radio lineup. And so people,
can
go to Coffee Party USA, and they can see your show, a couple other good shows, and then we've been added too. So I'm very proud of that because you're such a good organization. But let's get to some of the issues.
Okay.
I know on your show this week, and it's been in the news, and I guess most people look at it as being a frightening but yet done deal, and that's Governor Brewer's veto of the anti-gay bill that authorizes companies to discriminate against people for religious reasons. Janine, generally, what are your thoughts on it?
Well, there's a big topic right there. We were all watching sort of with bated breath last night to see what Governor Brewer would do, because on the one hand, there's a very strong religious right presence in the Republican Party. Arizona is a Republican-dominated House, Senate, and governorship. And on the other hand, that other piece of the Republican Party, the business interests, were very, very, very unhappy with this. And, of course, those of us who sort of live and breathe civil liberties, we're erring more on the side of business with this one. And so when her announcement came out last night that she was going to veto the bill, just like she vetoed a similar bill last year, it wasn't shocking, but it was a relief to me. Because I think this kind of legislation is it's almost anti-American. A country that is founded on the premise of religious freedom is now, people are trying to say, well, there's religious freedom for me, but not for you. And, I don't know what to do with that other than to resist it whenever I see it.
Well, it's reminiscent, and we've seen the ads or the Facebook postings on it. It's reminiscent of the Nashville lunch counter protests a number of years ago in determining who can be served and who can be refused to be served. But there was one there was one interesting aspect of it, Janine, that I kind of wondered that if it had passed, if she did not veto it, and somebody would refuse to serve somebody for religious reasons, well, one would think that they could be challenged in court, and thereby a corporation or a business would have to declare its religious affiliation. And under the corporate personhood situation, you could see that getting really ugly really fast, but it would be a I won't say humorous, but I will say ironic twist if corporations had to comply by completing their personhoodness. Do you like how I make up those words, Janine? Complete their personhoodness.
Oh, I do it all the time. I'm right there with you. Well, and you know what's really powerful to me about this? I'm a retired business owner. I had employees in 3 Western states, and I cannot imagine trying to implement something like this because, employers were also at risk in this law. If an employee of mine had wanted to not serve one of my clients because of some religious belief, I have to tell you, if that had not been disclosed to me in an interview, if someone hadn't told me that they planned to only do the work they thought was religiously appropriate, my right to have selected my workforce would have been violated. I would have fired them on the spot. And it's kind of like there's need, if you're going to be totally transparent about this, there's a need for everybody to be upfront, because all I see here is that somebody wants the ability to discriminate in a non-predisclosed way, suffer no liability, and actually cause law enforcement and the courts to enforce their personal view. And that's just, it would never have stood a court test for sure. That never would have flown. And this really comes back to for me is that, it's actually legal in the United States of America, and it is constitutional, for you to have any religious belief you want. And within your private life to worship, to do whatever that's consistent with that belief. We also have social norms, and we've defined those sometimes as laws and we say this is our society, and in our society, one of the things we've said we don't like is discrimination. And so one of the things that was posted at the Washington Post, they basically said, listen, when someone goes into business, there's a presumption that you will serve any legitimate paying customer. Whether or not in this pluralistic society of ours, they happen to line up exactly with your tenets of faith. This is not a private matter. This is a public matter.
I was just thinking the injustice is further magnified because gays are allowed to openly serve in the military now. So gays are fighting for their religious rights, and yet they will not serve. If a gay serviceman came in, they would not serve that person. And so there's huge inconsistencies with this whole process. And I'm glad she vetoed it, but I'm really ashamed of the Arizona legislature for allowing it to go that far, and especially ashamed for the 3 Republican legislators in Arizona whom, after they voted, said, oh, we didn't really mean to vote for that. Really an embarrassing statement about governance in Arizona at this point.
Well, didn't it demonstrate mob mentality? I don't want to overstate it, but seriously, in that little cluster they called the legislature, somehow this sounded like a good idea. And then as soon as it was exposed to the light of day, they're going, uh-oh. Apple didn't like it, Southwest Air didn't like it, the NFL didn't like it. I mean, all of a sudden they're going, oh, this is more than just my little personal righteous indignation about having to serve someone I don't like. I mean, come on, this is the real world. And that's in my state, in Oregon, this is going to come up by referendum in November. They're end running the legislature and going to referendum. And I swear, this is just a little, I want to call it snarky, except I know that people have their religious beliefs, they hold them too close to use terms like that. But it really is kind of this bully mentality, and I don't understand why Americans are taking the bait.
Well, it's something. Certainly the decision and the process was done in ideological isolation, which unfortunately seems to prevail in the extremes of politics. Janine, let's go on to another topic. It's something that we talked about 2 weeks ago when we were discussing issues, and it was Obama and Karzai, and I think we said, why are we even supporting Karzai? You know, the guy is a loser on so many fronts. And so now Obama has given kind of an ultimatum, saying, well, if you want 7,000 to 15,000 troops to stay in Afghanistan through 2024, you're going to have to sign this agreement, this certain agreement. And Karzai, triangulating for the post-United States interval there where he can gain whatever, hasn't signed the agreement. But here is what is a new aspect of Obama's ultimatum and Karzai's lack of response. And I'll just read this from a column by George Zornick, and said, House Speaker John Boehner, perhaps sensing political opportunity, echoed those sentiments late Tuesday after the Obama-Karzai call and news of the zero-option ultimatum broke. Over the last, and I quote, over the last year, our commander-in-chief has often talked more about how we plan to leave Afghanistan than how we're going to achieve our mission, Boehner said. Janine, my question for you is, what is our mission?
Well, isn't that an interesting question? You know, I think I know pretty clearly what our mission was not. And our mission was not to stay there for 10, 12 years. Our mission was not to have, you know, hundreds of thousands of collateral damage deaths. It was not to have twice that many people die of starvation and, the consequences of a broken infrastructure. So, first of all, I think it was pretty disingenuous, what our mission was in the first place. It started out, go find Osama bin Laden, and then it morphed to something totally different. And because I knew this was a possibility, and I did think unfulfilled mission. Oh, man, the literature right now on the web is full of that phrase. So, that's a storybook phrase for us. That's a talking point. And right now, the only thing I see unfulfilled are expectations of government contracts for an amazing number of things that could have gone on longer and will not. You know, we're going to actually keep our word and leave, which I think is very good. And I think the withdrawal is awkward. I think it always was going to be awkward. I think our mission was awkward. And I'm not sure what the today's mission is. I'm just pretty sure what it wasn't.
Well, I think it puts us in a position that if we were encountering someone whose thoughts coincided with Boehner's, we should ask, could you please tell us what our mission is, rather than defend ourselves for pulling out by saying our mission is unfulfilled. I would pose the question to those, what is our mission, please, in one sentence, and then they'll give something nebulous, I'm sure. But anyway, it's sick. I'm hoping Karzai doesn't sign it. I'm hoping we're out of there and let somebody else worry about that. Janine, why don't we go to a commercial real quick? And when we come back, I want to talk about Monsanto antitrust investigation and a number of other things. Dave Camp's corporate tax plan, corporate welfare, IRS public comment about dark money groups, a number of things. So if you've fastened your seatbelt and you're ready for the next segment, I'm ready to do it after this commercial. How does that sound, Janine?
It sounds excellent.
Okay, we're talking with Janine Loudon, who is the host of Lunch with Loudon, Thursdays at, I guess that would be 3 o'clock Eastern Time, noon Pacific, for Coffee Party USA Radio. You're listening here on Tim Danahy Show at Danahy.com. We'll be right back.
Why do the baby stars have enough food to feed the world? Why wouldn't there so many of us or there people still alone?
Welcome to this episode of Danahy.com's American History Minute, a one-minute story about little-known events. Today's story comes from Patrick O'Donnell, author of Dog Company. Here's today's story. After D-Day, U.S. forces were advancing faster than supply lines. We needed food and munitions to replenish our men. We needed the French seaport of Brest, but it was fortified with 50,000 German troops ringed with minefields and pillboxes. The heart of the defenses was the Lockrist Battery, massive guns surrounded by concrete bunkers. These guns defended the port of Brest. On September 6, Lieutenant Bob Edlin noticed a small footpath through the minefield the locals used to supply one of the pillboxes. Edlin and three men surprised the Germans inside, and they surrendered without a shot. Edlin asked one German, "Will you lead us to the Fort Commandant?" "Yes," he said. So Edlin and one man marched through the front door, the subterranean corridors, and stunned Germans to the main office. The shocked commandant sat at his desk. Edlin said, "Why don't you just surrender the whole fort and get this over with?" The commandant said, "There's two of you and 800 of us." Edlin put a grenade between the commandant's legs. "Surrender now or I release the grenade." The commandant paused, got on the public address system, and ordered the fort to surrender. Lieutenant Edlin and one man captured the entire Lockrist Battery and opened the French coast to resupply the Allied invasion of Europe. This story has been provided by The Tim Danahy Show. Please like us on Facebook at Tim Danahy Show and follow us on Twitter at hashtag Tim Danahy Show. And thank you for listening at Danahy.com.
Why is a woman still not safe when she's in her home? Love is here.
You preserve a nation one community at a time with shared knowledge and an informed electorate, with many voices speaking with civility and integrity. And we will preserve our nation when we participate, we learn, we discuss, we vote. We are the Coffee Party USA. Join today. CoffeePartyUSA.com.
War is peace. No is yes. We're all free. But somebody's gonna have to answer. Time is coming soon. Amidst all these questions and contradictions, the son who speaks truth, tell me, why do the baby starve? There's enough food to feed the world. Why wouldn't there so many of us? There are people still alone.
Welcome back to the Tim Danahy Show here at Danahy.com, and we are talking with Janine Loudon, who is the host of Coffee Party USA Radio's Lunch with Loudon, which is heard 3 o'clock Eastern, noon Pacific. You can listen online at coffeepartyusa.com and get all the information to access her wonderful show. All right, Janine, we've covered a couple of things. We've talked about Arizona. We've talked about Afghanistan. You know, as long as we're on the topic with A's, beginning with the first letter, perhaps we could do antitrust. The Department of Justice has been investigating Monsanto's GMOs product line for antitrust for the last 2 years. And a couple months ago, they just stopped. There was no press release. There was no announcement, nothing. They just stopped. And so people such as Diana Moss, who is with the Antitrust Institute, everybody's wondering what's going on. And Monsanto doesn't give an excuse, and the Department of Justice said in making its decision, the antitrust division took into account marketplace developments that occurred during the pendency of the investigation. And whenever they asked what were the marketplace developments, they said, "I don't have anything else for you." What is going on here, Janine?
Well, I often ask myself that when it comes to the whole food production industry in our country today, but Monsanto in particular is an incredible heavyweight. And I know that we sort of watched what a public conversation about government ruling can look like when the Monsanto Protection Act was being discussed. And that, of course, is it was an end run that prevented the courts from evaluating when a USDA decision had any agricultural product into a non-regulated status. And so even though new information might develop downstream and there might be impacts to agriculture later, once it got this unregulated status, it was not to be questioned. The courts couldn't bring it up. Local jurisdictions couldn't bring it up. It was really kind of like a, you know, Superman's steel against the world. And it was very shocking to everybody how that played out. So I'm not surprised that they could do a similar thing with this Antitrust Act, and I'm not surprised that this time there wasn't much public conversation about it, you know, that it was sort of happened on the dark side of a Friday afternoon and went under the rug immediately. The Monsanto Protection Act discussion was pretty damaging, I think, to their reputation, and it was a big public relations nightmare for them, as was the Farm Bill, you know. Although they get hidden along with other major, providers of, you know, the 15% of farmers that actually produce all the food, and they're among, you know, that special interest group.
Well,
plus they got what an $8 million annual lobbying budget. So, or $8 million. Yeah.
Well, Monsanto's power is enormous, and I find it sickening. Actually, I think that would be the appropriate adjective, that they're running commercials saying how 90s make up a percentage of their commercial. 97% of America's farms are family farms. Well, the truth of the matter is those are almost sharecroppers who are beholden to the big four meat producers, to the big agricultural interests. And it's really... The Department of Justice has backed off on this, Janine, but would you say it's fair that we need to continue to put the pressure on them regarding GMOs and corporate accountability?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Years and years ago, I worked in an R&D lab, and one of the things that we did there was try to replicate scientific research that occurred somewhere else. You know, I mean, that's... can't replicate the research, then it's not a valid scientific study, right? And so I had the capacity at Occupational Health and Safety there, and I had to read all the research protocols and work with the scientists to make sure that we didn't hurt ourselves, each other, or the neighborhood when we did this kind of investigative work. So way back then, we were dealing with some of the early GMOs, right? I can promise you this. We could keep it under control in a fume hood, and we could maintain control in a containment lab. But as soon as any of this stuff left the laboratory and went out to the greenhouse, even though the air was filtered in, the air was filtered out, you walked through a solution in your wellies to get in and out of the greenhouse, you wore a lab coat and all of that, this stuff escaped. It is, and, you know, it was our job to make sure. And so here's what I know about GMOs. It's more fond of nature than it is of the lab, and it will do what biology does, and that is find a way to reproduce itself. So one of the big problems with GMO is, what if you don't want it? You know, you don't even have to ask yourself yet whether or not it's safe. That's a whole other branch of science. But if you don't want it and it's in the field, you will get it because you can't contain it. It's biological. It's biology in action. And so I think there needs to be a whole lot more research done before these things are released to the field. And I think there needs to be a whole lot more scrutiny on what happens when it escapes. So,
well, the whole world is showing extreme caution. I think Monsanto had to pull up its GMO stakes in Europe as an example. And I think they're fighting to get back in through the European equivalent of the TPP, the Trans-Pacific Partnership. There's one going on for Europe now too, so they're trying to get their way back in there. But once again, we've got to stay on top of that issue. It's not going away, and if anything, it's going to get worse. Janine, how...
Well, and this is one of the liabilities of smaller government. The smaller the government, the less able it is to regulate or even investigate giants like Monsanto.
Well,
our only advantage is if government can stand toe-to-toe with the people it intends to regulate.
Well, bless your heart for saying that, Janine, because that's something that I have advocated for so long. Everybody wants smaller government, you know, and I say, well, no, I actually like a government that's accountable, that the people hold accountable. And I always say, I want my government big enough to be stronger than the corporations. And, you know, you're the first person to acknowledge that fact. We need to have big government if we're going to have big corporations. Make small corporations, break them up, we can have a smaller government. So, Janine.
Precisely.
You're getting a radio gold star for that, Janine. Thank you.
You're welcome.
All right. So, we're going to go on to Dave Camp, the chairman of the House Ways and Means Committee. We've got two topics. I'll give one first off. The IRS, and this is a pro-IRS story, if you can believe that. These poor people down at the IRS that have to enforce these labyrinthine tax codes, I feel sorry for them because their funding is cut. They don't have money to investigate the wealthy that deliberately defunded. I mean, just... It's got to be a hard place to work, but the IRS just finished the period of time that invited public comment for the 501c4 organizations, and what they want to do is create new rules that talk about the dark money that go into these 501c4s, and it's called social welfare groups, but they spend millions of dollars in elections in 2012, for example, without disclosing the donors. So the IRS are saying this isn't right. It's a social welfare group. Nobody's telling how much money's going in, and they're using it to influence elections. Would you like to give three cheers for the IRS for pursuing this?
Actually, yes, I would. The Coffee Party USA is a 501c4, 4c, however you said that. And so we are a private nonprofit, and we fell into the scrutiny that so many groups that started in 2010 fell into. And I have exactly the opposite reaction that you might read in your everyday newspaper, which is, bring it on, you know, because... they were overwhelmed with these groups coming in. They could hardly process them. There were so many. And they have a duty to perform. And so we jumped through a few extra hoops, and it took some extra time. But, you know, we came out the other side just fine. In our case, our mission has to do with uniting the many, many communities of America, bringing together the possibility of conversation between them, and united taking on the problems and the issues of our day. And so it's totally outside our purview to endorse a candidate. And we do not endorse candidates, but we will ask all candidates certain questions. You know, like, what is your opinion on Citizens United? What do you intend to do to reverse the Citizens United impact? Those kinds of things. That's within the purview of these organizations. Giving anybody money, giving anybody airtime, giving anybody promotion as an individual is, you know, for us, absolutely out of the question. And yet you turn around, you find other groups like us who, as you just said, you know, are filtering dark money campaign coffers. Well, and I think that they should be found and dealt with.
Well, I promised you a Dave Camp twist to this, and the chairman of the House Ways and Means Committee, and he's upset that the IRS would be looking to end the anonymity of the donors into 501c4. So sure enough, whenever something positive is happening to shine lights on the democratic process, there's someone out there who has a complaint about it. Janine, we have to go to another commercial, but when we come back, I want to do another Dave Camp story, if that sounds good to you.
Sounds good.
All right, we're talking with Janine Loudon, who is the host of Coffee Party USA's radio show called Lunch with Loudon, which is heard Thursdays, 3 o'clock Eastern Time, noon Pacific. And you're listening here on The Tim Danny Show at danny.com. We'll be right back.
When there ain't to kill, why is a woman still not safe when she's in her home?
It's what we don't know that kills us. That's especially true for nutrition. America is fighting an obesity epidemic, and much of it occurs in poor communities. That's why Grocery Ships gives scholarships for groceries so low-income families can buy fresh, healthy food for 6 months. We teach how to plan nutritious meals, buy the ingredients, and cook them. We help track weight, cholesterol, and glucose. Most of all, we network support to make sure healthy eating stays forever. We want your help at groceryships.com. Contact us. Learn more. Donate. Let's make a difference. Groceryships.com.
Love is here. War is peace. No is yes. You're all free.
Welcome back to the Tim Danhe Show here at danhe.com, and we're talking with Janine Loudon, who is the host of Coffee Party USA's radio show Lunch with Loudon, which is heard Thursday at 3 p.m. Eastern Time, noon Pacific. And I'm just so proud as can be, Janine, really, to be have my show now listed as one of the Coffee Party USA radio partners. And so you're listing my show there, and I really appreciate working with you guys. You guys are a great organization. I encourage all listeners to join. Okay, I promised another Dave Camp story. Dave Camp, the chairman of the House Ways and Means Committee, he revealed his tax plan. And I'll quote Harry Reid and just say, well, you know, he appreciates the fact that he gave a solid piece of legislation to be considered. He deserves credit for that, so let's give it there. But he wants to do the typical thing. He wants to lower the corporate tax rate from 35% down to 25%, he says, to make the U.S. more competitive. But the truth of the matter is, Janine, and you know this as well as I, that's the listed tax rate, but the effective tax rate, the amount that the taxes they really pay, is one of the, I think it's either the second or third lowest in the world. And so, but there's one clause in this tax proposal that Dave Camp brought forth, and that is that he's going to make it easier to park money offshore. I'll read something from Citizens for Tax Justice, and bear with me. It's a couple sentences, and I know, Janine, that the worst thing you do on radio is read, but I'll do my best with this. They said, Camp's plan actually expands corporate tax loopholes in some ways. One problem with our current tax code is a rule allowing American corporations to defer paying U.S. taxes on profit that are officially offshore, which encourages companies to make their U.S. profits appear to be earned in countries where they won't be taxed at all. Camp claims that several of his proposals would address this, but under the proposal, the default rule would be that most offshore profits are taxed at a rate of just over 1%, essentially increasing the rewards for any American corporation that manages to make its U.S. profits appear to be earned in Bermuda or the Cayman Islands. Janine, are you sick of this?
Well, so my favorite quote, though, about this is he said that the tax code is 10 times the size of the Bible with no good news. And I thought, well, so is this. And so I hold in my heart of hearts that the United States does not have a spending problem as much as it has a revenue problem. And again, coming at this as a retired business person, what I see is we have discounted our product to the point of bankruptcy. In other words, if we're not making the cash flow work, if we're not making it flow, why aren't we upping the price? Why are we cutting back the product? I mean, this is you might as well shut the door and have a fire sale if this is your philosophy about how you fiscally manage an organization. You know, we've given so many discounts in the form of tax cuts and tax breaks and subsidies and loopholes that we're putting ourselves out of business. And so this guy comes up with, well, we could make the loopholes really easier.
Well,
you know, we could make You know, I don't see this helping revenue. I see this just another smarty pants workaround to make it look like you're making progress when you're really, you know, on your way to a fire sale. And I don't get it.
Well, Jeanine, you really bring up another good point, your second gold star of the day. You know, obviously, we're going to be mailing them to you. But the United States, as a percentage of GDP, federal taxes are the lowest now than they have been in 60 years. You're right. It's not a spending problem. It's a revenue problem. Because we seem to have an expectation of government services. And within that broad term expectations, we have things in there such as GE expects a subsidy, Boeing expects a subsidy. Those are expectations. But we simultaneously expect a highway system or whatever we the people expect, which isn't much anymore. But obviously we're not generating enough revenue to match expectations. If we want to lower expectations, fine, but nobody seems to be willing to give any more. So the fact, I think you identified the problem that it's a revenue issue and Dave Camp is not helping at all.
No. And the thing is, it's probably possible to simplify the tax code. You could probably, you know, but what I want to see is someone with more skin in the game make the first move. Like, okay, Monsanto, we just talked about Monsanto. Monsanto has huge skin in the game. If our society were to crumble, it would make a difference to them, right? And yet they pay less and less and less, not more and more and more, not even the same. And so I say drop the loopholes and see what happens. If you still need if you still need tax code reform after you drop the loopholes, the subsidies, the exemptions, the things that make the tax code sick, by the way. It's not just your basic tax code that is 10 times the size of the Bible. It's probably the size of the Bible, and then there's 9 more volumes of special interest exceptions, tax cuts, loopholes, et cetera. So, you know, we can piece this together better than we can reform it outright, I think. Because, you know, you buy the horse, you got to take her home. And I can't see us being able to afford this big a guess. It's a guess. And very uncomfortable with it.
Well, it's an absurdity if this is the best that they can do and if this is their definition of justice for corporate taxes. Jeanine, if I can, I want to move on. David K. Johnston, a friend of the show, he's been on a number of times, and he has come out with a report through Al Jazeera. He said the shocking numbers behind corporate welfare. And he cites statistics put together by an organization, a great organization called Good Jobs First. And it says that state and local governments have awarded at least $110 billion in taxpayer subsidies to businesses, with 3 out of 4 of those dollars going to fewer than 1,000 big corporations. And then he went on to say, we mentioned Boeing earlier. Boeing, incidentally, has not paid, let me just double check this. Boeing has not paid corporate taxes for the last 5 years, but yet they have ranked first with 137 subsidies totaling $13.2 billion last year, which parenthetically they're asking the union for concessions. And then it goes on to Alcoa, Intel, General Motors, Ford, and so forth. I suspect this $110 billion is light, especially when you factor in things like urban renewal districts and incremental tax financing and so forth. This idea that we need to subsidize corporations and we become competitive between states and municipalities to attract business is really a road to nowhere, isn't it?
Well, I think it is. I mean, I live in Oregon now, and I can't tell you the number of enticing deals the state or a local county or local city has cut for jobs. You know, the promise of jobs. Maybe they get a 10-year tax, tax reduction, or 10 years tax-free, and then year 11 they start paying taxes. They're cutting deals left and right. We're building roads for them. We're running sewers for them. We're altering traffic patterns. We're, you know, the infrastructure investment, I don't feel, is fairly represented here. You know, you know, what it takes to put in even a big box store. It's huge. It's a huge infrastructure investment on the part of what in Oregon are relatively small cities, right? And that 10-year clock goes off, and they're gone.
Well,
they're gone.
Yeah, and
you know, or they never open. You put in the infrastructure. There's a big box store in the town 10 miles from me here that has is delayed and delayed and delayed. And so the return on investment, the promise is not kept. The integrity is not there. And the long-term goal, obviously the event horizon for the business was how long can I make a profit based on subsidy? And then they're done. Whereas the event horizon for a jurisdiction is, how many jobs for how long, you know, are these family wage jobs? Are they, you know, it's apples and oranges what the government expects, what the people expect versus what the shareholders expect. And that, I think, has turned out to be a dirty deal in way too many cases.
Well, we could just take Walmart as an example. You know, as subsidies, Walmart was not mentioned in the report, but they did a study, and it turns out that each Walmart actually generates about $900,000 a year in state and local subsidies to compensate for its low-income workers, because the workers go on to government-assisted housing, government-assisted health care and food stamps and a number of other things. So this number, this $110 billion, I suspect is way too low. And so anyway, it's just one more instance of how.
Well,
go ahead.
Well, but you're exactly right. It's only one instance. And the other thing is, like, no kidding. People are making an investment for the long haul, and companies are in it for the short run. You know, that money's going to morph. That money's going to follow profitability. And the minute reality strikes and they're paying property tax, they're paying income tax, they're actually being a contribution to this community within which they are making profit, they're not so friendly, and they're not even likely to stay. Now, in defense of Boeing and Alcoa and all of that, they have huge facilities. There is huge infrastructure involved that they themselves build, and there is an incredible number of people, for example, in the Seattle area that actually work for Boeing. For Boeing to lose jobs would be a big taxation on that community, as a matter of fact, on the entire Sound. And so there's this interesting ball you have to juggle, which is, at what point does it behoove the people to contribute to this financial venture? And at what point is it a lost league? And that, for the smaller things like the Walmarts and the big box stores, I don't think they're ever a good investment. They come and go too quickly. Alcoa, Boeing, others, I bet they'll survive and be profitable with less support from their community, but they're more integral in their community than any Walmart ever thought of being.
Well, I look at Boeing now, and in all honesty, it's a public utility. It is our defense aircraft manufacturer. Yes, Lockheed does a little bit, but Boeing is not going to fail. Its profits and its subsidies will accrue to the shareholders, but it will not fail because the United States cannot be left without a defense aircraft manufacturer. And so the shareholders will reap rewards from its guaranteed existence. However, the public will be subsidizing it, and it's a one-way street. Hey, Janine, we got to take another break, and then I want to come back. And are you in the mood for a Trans-Pacific Partnership story?
Ooh, always.
Okay. We're talking with Janine Loudon, who is the host of Lunch with Loudon on CoffeePartyUSA.com's radio lineup. And it can be heard Thursdays at 3 o'clock Eastern, noon Pacific. And you're listening here at the Tim Danny Show at Danny.com. We'll be right back.
But somebody's going to have to answer. The time is coming soon when the blind remove their blinders and the seats that speak the truth.
Teddy Roosevelt said, of all forms of tyranny, the least attractive and the most vulgar is the tyranny of mere wealth. This is why antitrust law and competition is essential to America's economic health. This is why the Organization for Competitive Markets works to reclaim competition for farmers, ranchers, and rural communities across America. We believe our duty is to advocate a just role for government in the agricultural economy, an enforcer of rules necessary for markets that are fair, honest, and accessible. The Organization for Competitive Markets. Learn more at competitivemarkets.com.
Tell me, why do the babies starve? There's enough food to feed the world. Why wouldn't there so many of us? There are people still alone.
Welcome back to the Tim Danahy Show here at danahy.com. We're talking with Janine Loudon, who is the host of Lunch with Loudon on CoffeePartyUSA.com's radio network. And they are heard Thursdays at 3 o'clock Eastern, noon Pacific. And Janine, Trans-Pacific Partnership, nobody likes it except the biggest of the big corporations. And it's just been a heroic struggle to put that beast back in the cave. And so now it appears that the TPP grandmasters, the Darth TPP, or whoever it is that's in charge of these things, the 300 or 600 corporations that are giving inputs to it, they realize now that there seems to be some public dissent with it. So out of their 16 industry trade advisory committees that are putting this top secret thing together that even our senators cannot partake or take a look at, they have one labor committee, and now they're going to create a public interest committee as well. And so how do you feel about, out of now 17 industry trade advisory committees, there's one labor committee and there's now one public interest committee. How do you feel about that?
So doesn't it kind of remind you of when they created, what did they call them, the political action zone at the inauguration?
Yes.
And so all the political activists were like put in this cage that was like two blocks away from where the president was going to pass. And it... So it's like, oh my gosh, what have we done? So it almost, maybe this is an appeasement, you know. But I have to say, Peter DeFazio is my representative in Congress, and he calls the TPP evil. And he says that, let's see if I can get the quote, it's less about trade and more about deregulation. And that's why it's such a secret, because it's really, you know, what's the latest and greatest sneaky thing we can do to forward our individual economic interests through this agreement. He refuses to read it because he says that in order to read it, people and armed guards bring the document to your office. You are not allowed to take notes. They stand there and watch you read it. And then when the time is up, they pick it up and take it away. And so, I mean, since when is a trade agreement that proprietary? Well, because it's about deregulation. It's not about trade. This whole thing is creepy to me. And I think having a little committee to go hide activism in, or to have the single face of activism on this issue, you know, obviously if they do it, people will play that game. But I don't think it should stop our individual responsibility to call for better transparency and call for better endgame results from a trade agreement for the country. If we've learned nothing in the last couple decades, it's that trade agreements tend not to serve their spoken purpose.
Well, I look at trade agreements, trade should be a privilege, not a dictate from an overarching agreement. But I look at this public interest committee, Janine, and first of all, we don't know who's going to be on it. You know, I mean, maybe Tom Donahue of the Chamber of Commerce, or, you know, as a citizen.
I
give that as an example. You don't know who's going to be on it, for one. But what I suspect is going to happen is that they're not going to get access. They're not going to be able to give much input on it. What the press release is, whenever the TPP is ready to be, rolled out, really it's steamrolled into Congress, what they're going to do is say, based on industry, labor, and public interest inputs, this is the marvelous new bill that for which you should all vote yes. I think this is just nothing but a public relations stunt, and I would be very disappointed if you really want to put teeth on it, let Elizabeth Warren and Bernie Sanders appoint somebody to the Public Interest Committee, and let's let the fur fly.
Right, right. I mean, this. I understand the intent of trade agreements. I understand how trade agreements get used, abused, misused, and this has all the trappings of a big mistake. You know, especially in terms of the American worker. And since, you know, back in the day, most of us were workers, and today it's very difficult to join that team. I think that we ought to be looking out for our own jobs and our own internal economic security before we start looking for, you know, what kind of trade agreements Monsanto and Disney and AT&T can make with a foreign national. I'm very suspect.
Well,
very uncomfortable.
Yeah, whenever you look at these trade agreements and how they make it so any nation, any municipality, any state that enacts legislation that perhaps even the higher minimum wage, which will be a segue to our last topic, but if they enact legislation doing a higher minimum wage, well, then they have to pay the corporation for the lost profits under TPP because they don't want to pay it. And so the operative question in this case, much like we were going to ask Boehner, you know, what is our mission? The question is for the TPP, what is the mechanism that allows the expansion of worker rights and compensation? There's none. And the TPP is a fraud. And if anybody has not written their congressman, I would encourage them to do that now.
Absolutely. Okay. Absolutely. Well, I'm with you on that.
All right. Let's get the last topic in. And because actually this is, you live in Oregon, close to Washington, and there's some other instances. But Washington, I think, is really at the crossroads of this issue. Bloomberg came out with a report, and it said higher minimum wage hasn't killed jobs. And Washington has a high minimum wage. I believe it's the second highest behind San Francisco. And this report cites that they haven't lost any jobs. They still, by all indicators, have a very vibrant economy, even at border areas like Spokane and Coeur d'Alene, where Idaho does not have a higher minimum wage. It's really not much effect one way or the other. Do you think that these would be good examples to say, hey, U.S., minimum wage is not a bad thing? Minimum wage increase is not a bad thing.
Oh, no. I mean, it's actually kind of crazy. It's crazy making that the minimum wage hasn't climbed with other economic indices. It's like, well, Oregon's minimum wage is $9.10 an hour. And I think that there has been the occasional shifting, you know, jobs lost, jobs gained, you know, my personal experience here. But ultimately, minimum wage isn't supposed to be defining prevailing wage. It's supposed to be saying, if you work for less than this, you're giving your labor away because the state is going to have to subsidize the difference, you know. So the folks that don't get food stamps because they actually make enough money to buy food, this is a good thing. And the folks that actually can go rent an apartment without a subsidy, this is a good thing. And so I find it interesting, the conversation that says, oh, this is bad for business, but actually what it does is shift what the consumer pays from paying taxes to the state to support these people to actually paying just directly for what they get. So if the price of a Big Mac goes up, wahoo! You know?
Well, yeah,
you should be able. I'm all for it.
I have a friend who has a coffee shop, a really good man. He says, oh, no. He goes, minimum wage is going up 20%, and therefore I'm going to have to raise my prices 20%. And I told him, and I went through the numbers with him, and I said, all right, let's go through the numbers here. And I said, really, it only has a 3 percentage point effect on your prices. And I know McDonald's could pay their workers, and I'm talking off the top of my head, I think they could double the workers' wages, and the price of the dollar menu would simply go from $1 to $1.19. If I went to McDonald's, I would be proud to pay that, just knowing that they took care of their people. Much like I love Costco, but you could not pay me to go into a Walmart. You know, I like companies who take care of their employees, and I tend to frequent them. I think it's good for business as Gap, the retail clothing chain, has said they're going to go ahead no matter what the federal government does. They're going to pay their employees more because they realize a better paid employee is a more engaged and more productive employee.
Right, right. Well, and I'm from the old school. You know, we used to believe as employers that it was a part of the social contract that access to health care, for example, came through the employer. You know, the ability to sustain yourself came through employment. And so I know people my age probably have a very different attitude about this compared to the sort of the new school thinking. But really, the entitlement in this whole conversation, the notion that shareholders are entitled to a return, that the return that they're entitled to is almost fixed, and that everything else has to adjust so that these shareholders get that return, or they leave, you know, they pull out and they go somewhere else, is what's driving this conversation.
Well,
that kind of entitlement.
It's like a bank, you know, they always say the reason they charge so much on their interest rates is for a risk premium. And you're thinking, excuse me, you know, I think the public is bearing the risk of your operations. They have very little, and as a result, they have exorbitant returns. Hey, Janine, what do you say? Same time, same place, 2 weeks from now?
Hey. It's a date.
All right. I like that. And that is Janine Loudon, who is the host of Lunch with Loudon on CoffeePartyUSA.com's radio lineup, of which I'm very proud to be a new addition to that. You can hear her at Thursday at 3 o'clock Eastern Time, noon at Pacific Time. And Janine, once again, it's been a delight to have you here on DanHe.com.
Well, thanks for having me. I've had a lot of fun.
It's a pleasure.
Why are the little salt peacekeepers when they're aimed to kill? Why is a woman still not safe when she's in her home?
The Tim Danahy Show would like to thank Aaron Taylor of SRC Labs for IT strategy, social media support, and event management. Personas, a leading designer and manufacturer of audio recording software, hardware, and related accessories available at Guitar Center. For Edward Danahy for post-production assistance, and Theodore, the studio dog, for his quiet companionship.
Love is hate, war is peace, war is death, we're all free.
Hey. Hi, this is Dan Aronson, and you're listening to Press One for Democracy. Heard here every Monday night on Coffee Party Radio starting at 9 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. Did you know that there's an entire lineup of Coffee Party Radio shows that airs each week? On Thursdays, our executive director, Janine Loudon, hosts Lunch with Loudon, starting at 3 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. On Saturdays, Egberto Willis hosts Politics Done Right, starting at 1 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. And the newest edition of our Coffee Party Radio family joins us on Sundays at 4 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. It's Bud Fields with Progressive Politics, Tennessee Style. And remember, unlike our current federal government, Coffee Party Radio is of the people, by the people, and for the people. Each show, you'll have the chance to call in at area code 646-929-2495 so you can stand up and be heard. When you can't make it with us live, remember that all of our shows are available to you 24/7 in our online archives. So again, this is Dan Aronson on behalf of all Coffee Party Radio hosts and our entire membership, saying thanks for joining us to discuss the issues of the day, the Coffee Party way.